You know, it's so hard to understand. With everything happening in Israel today, there are still Bible teachers who say, God's finished with Israel.
It's time for The Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Michael Brown is the director of the Coalition of Conscience and president of Fire School of Ministry. Get into The Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Let me read to you from Psalm 137, very famous words. By the waters of Babylon, there we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion. And the willows there we hung up our lyres. For there our captors required of us songs, and our tormentors mirth, saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How shall we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget its skill, or perhaps better to translate, let my right hand wither. Let my tongue stick to the roof of my mouth if I do not remember you, if I do not set Jerusalem above my highest joy. Remember, O Lord, against the Edomites, the day of Jerusalem, how they said, lay it bare down to its foundations, O daughter of Babylon, doomed to be destroyed. Blessed shall he be who repays you with what you have done to us. Blessed shall he be who takes your little ones and dashes them against the rock. You say, what an intense psalm. And what about those sentiments at the end of the psalm? Those righteous sentiments? We'll talk about that today on The Line of Fire. We'll answer the question, is God finished with Israel? We'll take your Jewish-related calls, and we'll talk about the death of the protesters in Gaza yesterday. Here's the number to call with any related questions, not any questions of any kind, but related specifically to our moving the embassy, to the conflict in the Middle East, to God's purposes for Israel, Jewish-related questions, 866-348-7884 is the number to call. I was looking at headlines. I was looking at many headlines last night, this morning, about the moving of our embassy, about world reaction to that, about the deaths of the protesters, Israeli forces shooting down protesters trying to breach the security fence on Gaza Strip going into the mainland of Israel. And you talk about controversy. You talk about Jerusalem being the city that stirs controversy around the world more than any other city on the planet. Just as you'd expect, based on scripture, just as you would expect. Look at this headline on CNN. All right, CNN says this. The dream, this is an op-ed piece from CNN senior international correspondent Ben Wiedemann. The dream of peace in our time in the Middle East died on Monday. Yeah. In other words, recognizing Jerusalem for what it is, the functioning capital of Israel, recognizing Jerusalem for what it is, the historic capital of Israel, recognizing Jerusalem for what it is, the heartbeat of the nation for all of these centuries in exile, talking about a physical location, simply recognizing that and doing what we've had on the books to do for decades, over 20 years on the books to do. This is now going to crush any hope of peace in our time in the Middle East. No, I say it makes much more realistic the chance for peace, because up until now, we were dealing with a fantasy that Jerusalem would not be the capital of Israel, or that everyone would just accept a divided Jerusalem. And this is not a statement of oppression against Palestinians. It is not a statement of hatred against Palestinians. It is a statement of saying Jerusalem has been the capital of Israel, will be the capital of Israel. From a prophetic standpoint, the Bible tells us clearly that Jesus is returning to a Jewish Jerusalem. As I've said repeatedly, our moving the embassy is both the right and righteous thing to do. Every other nation on the planet should follow suit. Should. Yes, they should. It's the right and righteous thing to do. And then you work out a peaceful arrangement with those that don't want to kill you. Simple. Oh, many complexities, massive complexities, but overall, simple in terms of these are realities. Here, another headline from Haaretz, which from its inception in the early history of modern Israel has been strongly left-wing, rejecting national policies for decades. You talk about freedom of speech in Israel almost from day one. You've had this militant opposition and strong support of the radical left from Haaretz. So Haaretz, here is an article, a predictable bloodbath in Gaza. Israel did not lift a finger to prevent lethal clashes. Hamas has been preparing for months for a storming of the fence, knowing it would end in dozens of deaths. A result, voices in Israel warned would come should Gaza's economic crisis not be eased. In other words, this is not the fault of Hamas. This is not the fault of their planning this out for months in an organized way. And I'll tell you how they've done it. Fascinating article in the Jerusalem Post about that. How they organized the protests, what protesters understood was going to happen, how likely it was that they were going to die or get wounded as they got to a certain point in seeking to breach the security fence. Remember, all this time, Hamas is spending millions and millions of dollars that could be going to help its own people. And Hamas is putting that money to build terror tunnels to go under Israel to try to kidnap and kill Israelis, long-term strategy. And Israel is locating more and more of them and blowing them up, thankfully. They are using money to build up their weaponry. They're using money for terrorist purposes that could be helping rebuild the infrastructure of Gaza Strip, that could be helping to build better schools and hospitals and apartments, and perhaps develop more job opportunities and things like that. Instead, they're using their money not to help the people, but to try to destroy Israel. Yes, there's an economic crisis in Gaza, but it is not to be laid at the feet of Israel. It's to be laid at the feet of Hamas. That's the bottom line. Under Israeli rule, the Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip were doing better than under Hamas. Those are facts. It's not to say everything Israel does is right. People get at me, why are you always defending Israel? I don't. I say that Israel needs to be held accountable. Israel needs to be held to high account. And where Israel violates ethics and justice, as friends of Israel, we need to call them to account for doing that. But it boggles my mind that the same Christians who live by grace 24/7, the same Christians who say, hey, I'm not perfect, just forgiven, the same Christians who say, well, you have to overlook my faults and my blemishes and all the faults and blemishes in church history and all of our shortcomings, etc. When it comes to Israel, oh, no, only by the law, not by grace. I mourn over the death of the Palestinians, but as we'll see in a little while, that blame, the blood of the Palestinians lies at the feet of Hamas. So let me say one more thing. Here's what's really sick. More dead Palestinians equals more success for Hamas. You say, what? See, here's the mentality. Hamas knows it can't fight and win a military war with Israel, so it fights a propaganda war with Israel. Get the nations of the world, get the world press hostile to Israel, even to the point of staging things. I'm not denying that there were many deaths and casualties yesterday. I grieve over that, all right? I wish it didn't happen. I'm not blaming Israel for it. Could some have been avoided? Probably. But the provocation and what was happening and how it was orchestrated, that lies at the feet of Hamas. The blame lies there. But I want you to step back and consider this. That when Hamas has success, it means look at all the civilian casualties. Look at all the children that are killed. Look, hang on. You were launching rockets from a hospital. This has happened. You were launching rockets from a children's school. You're using children and women as human shields. And if they're killed, then that's success for you. If Israel fires back and they get killed, that's success for Hamas. Israel sent out all kinds of pamphlets and warnings yesterday saying, don't come and protest. Don't try to take down the fence. Don't breach the security barrier. We have warned you. You'll be shot if you do. So what do? Hamas gets the protest going, and it has been documented in the past You can even, I've even seen videos where they're carrying a body out. Again, I'm not denying that there were many people killed and many, many hundreds wounded yesterday. I'm not denying that for a split second. But here's what happens. And I've seen video footage myself that here's a guy being carried out, killed, and then later you see him walking around the crowd. It's staged. Do you ever wonder why is it that Western journalists just happened to be there at the precise moment that a Palestinian child was killed or something else? You ever wonder about that? You ever wonder how much collusion there is between the terrorists and the Western press? Great article by Melanie Phillips on that we'll come to in a little while. Hamas is hurting the Palestinian people, not helping them. And if Hamas would put down its weapons and its murderous intents, it would be better for the Palestinians living in Gaza Strip. If they said, let's be at peace with our neighbor Israel, we don't want to annihilate you, we don't want to destroy you, we don't want to finish what Hitler started. We want to live side by side peacefully. Can we do it? Israel, if it was sincere and real, Israel would jump at the opportunity. Now, will we see full and lasting peace before Jesus returns? I don't believe so. I don't believe so. Will we see temporary peace? Probably. Wherever there can be peace, great. My fear is there will be a false peace, which will then lead to a final explosion and an Antichrist figure, etc. But this much I know, we're called to pursue peace, and we're called to pursue justice, and we're called to recognize what God is doing in the world and stand with God. So to me, standing with Israel doesn't just mean standing with prophetic scriptures, it means standing with what is right and just in the Middle East, and then calling on Israel when it does not treat Palestinian brothers and sisters rightly, calling Israel to account. So later this month, I'm scheduled to speak as a protesting voice, as a dissenting voice at the Christ at the Checkpoint conference in Bethlehem. And many of my Messianic Jewish friends have urged me, don't go, just your participation there legitimizes the event. They've asked me to come as Christian brothers. They have asked me to come and openly express my disagreements with them and challenge them, and they want to challenge me. It would not be right for me to refuse an invitation like that. And then we shall see if the conference is as bad as everyone says it is, and as it's been in the past, and if I'm just there as some kind of media ploy, you better believe we'll shout that out for the whole world to hear and see, and I truly hope that's not the case. If we can make some ground up, if we can understand each other better, if perhaps I can get them to see some of my viewpoint, they can sensitize me more to theirs, perhaps some good fruit can come out of it. All right, we'll come back, go to your calls, and I want to go back to Psalm 137.
The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown, your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Let me take you to an article by Aaron Klein on Breitbart.com. It's so ironic that Breitbart has been called anti-Semitic when you've had voices like Aaron Klein clearly speaking out for Israel, when you have one of the main editors, Joel Pollack, is an Orthodox Jew. Got a Jewish-related question for me? I'm going to the phones momentarily, 866-348-7884. That's 866-34-TRUTH. Here's what Aaron Klein writes, and he's absolutely correct in this. He says, journalists take Hamas terrorists' word as fact in Gaza riot coverage. And he writes this, Hamas desperate over its increasingly precarious situation in Gaza and eager to please Iranian paymasters, has escalated the premeditated, openly violent campaign aimed at breaching the Israel-Gaza border and attacking nearby Israeli communities. This while the news media hypes Hamas-provided casualty counts and portrays the Gaza rioters as peaceful protesters, frustrated that there is no Palestinian state and angry that the U.S. moved its embassy to Jerusalem. In doing so, the news media are actually advancing Hamas's cause. I tweeted this out yesterday. Hamas knows it can't defeat Israel militarily, so it fights a PR war. How does it do this? It sends its people to attack Israel. Israel then defends itself, killing the attackers. The media then follows the lead of Hamas and condemns Israel. So dead Palestinians equals success for Hamas. I mean, that's terrible, but true. White House Press Secretary Raj Shah said this about the deaths of more than 50 Palestinian protesters. Quote, the responsibility for these tragic deaths rests squarely with Hamas. Hamas is intentionally and cynically provoking this response. Very true. We'll open that up more for you as the show develops. First to the phones. We'll start in Michigan with Chris. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Hi, Dr. Brown. Really quick question. What are your go-to passages, like your bulletproof passages, that you believe tell of the Jews' future return to Israel?
Yeah, so all of the passages that spoke of the return from Babylonian exile that have not yet been fulfilled, which is basically all of them, all the prophecies beginning in Isaiah, the 40th chapter, all the prophecies in books like Ezekiel, chapter 36, all the prophecies throughout Jeremiah about return, you know, in chapters 30 through 33, some of what was prophesied happened, the rest of it didn't, which we understand, just like with the first and second coming of Jesus, that you have the beginning and then you have the fullness. So just as Jesus came at the expected time, but not with the expected glory and scope, that was for an ongoing historical development and for his return. So also with the return from Babylonian exile did not only speak of the rebuilding of the temple, but the regathering of Jews from all over the world. And then of the great things that God would do in the land and how the whole nation would turn to God and worship him with one heart, as for example was prophesied in Jeremiah 24. That did not happen. Isaiah 11, God speaks there about bringing the exiles back for a second time. So some would say, well, that meant first the Exodus, and then secondly, Babylonian exile. But the Exodus, this was not really exiles. It was the family of Joseph, family of Jacob going into Egypt and then being brought back out. There's the return from Babylon, and then the final end time return. A passage like Jeremiah 16 is one of the clearest, and just scrolling down to it, beginning in verse 14, therefore, behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when it shall no longer be said as the Lord lives who brought up the people of Israel out of the land of Egypt, but as the Lord lives who brought up the people of Israel out of the north country and out of all the countries where he had driven them. For I will bring them back to their own land that I gave to their fathers. So not just the Lord who brought the children of Israel out of Egypt, but from the north country, which in context would have been Babylon, even though Babylon was not to the north of Israel. To get there, you would go up around the Euphrates and then back down. So it was a northward journey. So here it's bringing the Jewish people back, the children of Israel, from all countries where they've been scattered. Ezekiel 36, an extended passage that says at that time back in the land, God will sprinkle clean water on them. As Bishop J.C. Ryle said, writing in the 1800s, that he foresaw the return of the Jewish people to the land in unbelief. That's what he understood prophecy saying. And then back in the land, God would turn their hearts to the Messiah. So basically all the prophecies about the return of the Jewish people from exile in Babylon that were not completely fulfilled still must be fulfilled because they were promises given by God.
All right, thanks.
You're very welcome. Cool. Sure thing.
Okay, thank you. Have a good day.
You bet. 866-34-TRUTH is the number to call. Let's go back to Psalm 137. Psalm 137, these are exiles in Babylonian captivity. And in anguish of heart, saying, hey, you want us to sing songs of Zion. How can we do that when we're in such agony here in exile? And these famous words, if I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand forget, normally taken forget its skill, King James forget its cunning, but it's best based on discovery of other Semitic languages and related words, it's best to understand the street, if I forget you, O Jerusalem, let my right hand wither, let my tongue stick to the roof of my mouth if I do not remember you, if I do not set Jerusalem above my highest joy. But now, at the end, there's an imprecation There's a word of judgment against the Edomites. Remember, these are brothers. This goes back to Jacob and Esau. Esau's basically the beginning of Edom. And the Edomites, as the Jewish people are being destroyed by the Babylonians, are rejoicing. And the psalmist says, well, oh yeah? Well, then happy is he. The Hebrew blessed there should really be happy. Truly happy is the one who takes your children and smashes them against the rocks. This is admittedly one of the most horrific pronouncements in the Hebrew scriptures, and one that critics point to and say, you point to Quran all you want. You got verses like this in the Hebrew Bible. What do you do about that? And perhaps verses like this that Andy Stanley was talking about when he made his ill-advised comments about unhitching from the Jewish scriptures, and we continue to be in ongoing friendly interaction about that, and he is every bit a gentleman that you'd expect him to be as we interact in the midst of our differences and affirm our areas of commonality. But you might say, well, yeah, I struggle with verses like that. And Andy Stanley would say, well, look to Jesus, look to his death and resurrection. Let's start there, and then we'll sort out these other passages. I understand the sentiment. And there are really only two ways to read this, as I would see it. One is the C.S. Lewis way of saying that not everything in the Psalms, just like not everything in Job, is meant to be taken as thus saith the Lord, meaning that if you go to the book of Job, you see there's a dialogue between the friends, and Job says this, and Eliphaz says this, and Job responds, and Bildad says this, and Job responds, and Zophar says this, and then Job comes back, and then Eliphaz, Bildad, you know, goes back and forth, and obviously they're arguing with each other, and then God rebukes Job, and God rebukes the friends. So by inspiration of the scripture, we have these incredible accounts and this incredible debate and this incredible dialogue laid out. That's utterly remarkable. That's extraordinary, the way it's laid out. But you can't just quote each one and say, well, that's what God says in his word, because it's a debate, and some of what's being said is wrong or wrongly applied. So C.S. Lewis would say that you take the canon of Christ and read the scriptures through that, and you would look at a verse like this and say that by inspiration of the Spirit, the psalmist's words were recorded, and some of them reflect his own anger. Some of them reflect his own frustration and are to be understood as such. That would be one way. Another way of reading this, and perhaps one that in certain ways is more historic, would be saying that psalms like this and psalms of imprecation are making prophetic pronouncements that the one who reaps this destruction will be doomed happy. Just like when Babylon falls in the book of Revelation, everyone shouts hallelujah. You say, yeah, but this is a little graphic. I agree. Under no circumstances are we pronouncing a blessing on someone or saying you're truly happy as you take babies of the enemy and smash their heads against rocks. God forbid. So again, one way it can be read is to say the Psalms are expressing human emotion, just like when the psalmist is being discouraged and saying, God's forgotten me. And that's what the psalm is saying. And frankly, there are certain psalms, if I prayed every word of for myself, I'd feel funny praying them. You know, in the midst of time of blessing and grace, darkness is my closest friend, you know, and everyone's turned against me. Well, I've had a lot of people turn against me, but not everybody. Never had my whole family turn against me. Or in other words, that was the psalmist's experience, but I can't say it's my experience at all times, nor are we supposed to take it in that way. But what I want to emphasize here is this: regardless of what we do with the end of the psalm, we know the ethic we're called to live by throughout the rest of the Bible and clearly throughout the New Testament. That's one. And two, the emphasis here is the deep, passionate connection that the people of Israel had with Jerusalem. And Isaiah 62 is a clear call. Isaiah 62 is a clear call to pray for Jerusalem, speaking about this physical city on the earth, to give God no rest until he makes it the praise of all the earth. Fact is, Jerusalem is mixed. Jerusalem has a lot of beauty, and Jerusalem has a lot of spiritual darkness and other darkness. And therefore, Jerusalem needs the coming of the Messiah, the coming of her Redeemer. But emphatically, I want to shout this for the whole world to hear. God is not finished with Israel. We'll be right back.
It's The Line of Fire with your host, Dr. Michael Brown. Get into the line of fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Well, here's the question Paul asked, Romans 11, 11. So I asked, did they, speaking of the Jewish people as a whole, speaking of the nation of Israel, speaking of those who rejected Jesus as Messiah, so I asked, did they stumble in order that they might fall? By no means. King James wanted to get this across so clearly, even though the words God or forbid are not in the Greek text. That's how they translated it. God forbid. By no means did Israel stumble so as to fall beyond the point of recovery. By no means. This is Michael Brown. You are viewing, listening to, participating in The Line of Fire broadcast. Here's the number to call, 866-348, with any questions about what's been happening in the Middle East, about the moving of our embassy, about the conflict with the surrounding nations, any Jewish-related question you have, as we normally do on Thursdays, I'm doing today as well, just as I did yesterday, because of the importance of these subjects. And please be sure to read my latest articles. I've got several articles written that are all relevant. Is God Finished with Israel? Came out today. Yesterday, Jerusalem, the Beautiful Jerusalem, the Ugly. Before that, can we use ancient texts, ancient biblical texts to solve contemporary Middle Eastern problems? Before that, differences with Pastor Andy Stanley about a Jewish-related recent message. And again, I have ongoing gracious interaction with Pastor Stanley, and I deeply appreciate the fact that I can express differences with him, and we continue to dialogue. That says a lot. 866-348-7884. So I tweeted out yesterday, replacement theology may not be dead, but it is dead wrong, as our embassy's move to Jerusalem today indicates. God's future purposes for Israel remain. In other words, the whole idea that God's finished with Israel, and here is Israel alive and well, with a population of more than 6 million Jews and then several million Arabs, the fact that Jerusalem still is the most controversial city on the planet, it is obvious that God's purposes remain. When I posted about the responsibility for the death of the protesters, that it lies at the feet of Hamas, and was posting what Deputy White House Press Secretary had said, someone posted this in response, just another MSM Zionist post. So suddenly I become part of the mainstream media. You Zionists always attempt to justify murdering Palestinians. Then when an Israeli dies, you cry bloody murder. You're evil hypocrites, plain and simple. Well, I'll be honest, when I get something like that from someone professing to be a Christian, I send back a sharp, honest reply, and then in some cases block someone like that, because if they're going to accuse me of justifying the murder of Palestinians, it's not the person I can have fruitful interaction with. Nonetheless, I always try to send them in the direction of truth if they want it. The fact is, in recent articles I'd written, I said Israel must be held accountable for its actions. But let's understand what actually happened with these protesters. And then I want to talk about God's purposes for Israel. We'll take your calls as well. A fascinating article I read this morning in the Jerusalem Post, and it talked about how things are actually organized. I mean, Hamas, for a period of months, was setting this up and was planning on having, what was it, roughly 2 months of protests leading up to, it would have been today, which is in Palestinian lore, al-Nakba, meaning the catastrophe, which is the founding of the modern state of Israel. And then it goes from there right into Ramadan. So it's a very intense period of time for Muslims, especially for Palestinian Muslims. So this has been organized now with the embassy being moved. Yesterday, they pushed back the culminating day one. So instead of culminating today, it culminated yesterday. And this is something that they're preparing people for. you will not see in the front lines of the protesters, the ones getting killed, you'll not find children, women. By and large, you'll find men, mainly young men. And you've got behind the crowds, you actually have prayer tents and food tents where people can come and eat and pray before they go and become shaheeds, in other words, martyrs, that they know they're going to go and try to breach the security zone, which Israel said, if you try to breach this, you will be killed. Otherwise, you're going to have thousands of people, many of them trained terrorists, breaching security fence, and then you shoot them? Is that right? Then you do it? This is reminiscent of when Iran fought Iraq, and both countries declared it a holy war, but because Iran was a much more religious country and Ayatollah Khomeini, much more religious man than Saddam Hussein, because of that, it was much greater emphasis put on this being a holy war by the Iranians. And so what they would do is they would have young people, I mean kids, 13, 14 years old, perhaps some even younger, but definitely that young, tens of thousands of them, they would be on the front lines and they would run towards the Iraqi army. And the Iraqis just would mow them down. What else are they going to do? They'd mow them down and then the other troops would follow. And so they were guaranteed paradise and all of this because they were martyrs for the cause. And I even saw a documentary once where this brother is mourning. He goes to visit his brother's gravesite all the time and ask him what was the defect in him that he didn't get to die the way they died. And this was also done not just to sap the munitions of the Iraqi soldiers, but to sap their emotions. Because it's very difficult for them to be killing all these kids day after day after day after day. It's a similar kind of strategy here, all right? It is cynical, it is ugly. And so you've got the organization behind it, you've got the Hamas protesters, you've got the leaders inciting the people, and then organizing, okay, who's going to run up here? This is fairly well documented, all right? And the goal is ultimately make Israel look bad. Don't be deceived, friends. This is what's going on. And Melanie Phillips, respected voice from the UK, listen to what she wrote about this. She has an article on her website, melaniephillips.com. Who's responsible for these Gaza deaths? The Hamas and their Western media enablers. She said that she's writing yesterday, the toll in today's Gaza riots, according to the Hamas, currently stands at around 55 Arabs dead, amongst whom say the Israelis are at least 10 Hamas terrorists. That toll may rise further with further riots threatened tomorrow and the day after. The people who caused these deaths are the Hamas themselves. By the way, Hamas in Hebrew means violence, but this is an acronym. This is an Arabic or Muslim brotherhood. So it's just coincidence that the same word sounds that way in Hebrew. So she writes this, the people at whose door these dead Arabs should also be laid are the BBC and those in the rest of the British and other media who have acted their part in the script of that Hamas has written to cause as many Gazans to lose their lives as possible. The younger, the better, so that the Western media will portray Israel as wanton and disproportionate killers. The media has duly obliged by calling what's been happening at Gaza's border with Israel today and previously unarmed demonstrations of protests against the U.S. embassy move. It was nothing of the kind. She says, as I wrote here yesterday, by the Hamas's own lights, this is an attempt by tens of thousands of Arabs to storm the border in order to invade and destroy Israel. If they do break through, no one can be in the slightest doubt that they will massacre the Israelis. In the words of the Hamas leader in Gaza, Yahya Sinwar, tear their hearts out. This is not a metaphor. Facebook pages affiliated with Hamas are uploading maps that show the proximity of the riots to Israeli communities. Quote, there's no other way to understand these pictures than as a threat against these communities, says the IDF spokesman, Brigadier General Ronen Manalis. That's why Israel has built extraordinary defenses to protect its most vulnerable citizens who live close to the border. And it is a lie to say, as the media continues falsely to report, that this great mob is unarmed. They're using petrol bombs, IEDs, flaming kites, and she goes on. The key point she makes, which I think is very, very important, is this. That the Western media is complicit in this. The Western media is reporting this in such a way that makes Israel look bad. You can use words like genocide and ethnic cleansing and look at these numbers and how many Israelis were killed. That's always the problem. If not enough Israelis are killed, then Israel looks bad. If Israel is precise in what it's doing, or if the protests are this open and protesters are willing to risk their lives to make a statement, and Israel shoots them down and Israelis aren't killed, well, look at the evil Israel. I mean, think of that. Think if we engaged with a war against terrorists and people trying to breach our border violently, and we didn't have casualties and they did, that we get blamed. But that is the state of things. Friends, my heart goes out to the Palestinians. My heart goes out to them. They are under corrupt leadership with Hamas and with the Palestinian Authority. Pray that God would raise up righteous leaders for these Arab peoples living in the Middle East, and that with those righteous leaders, righteous agreements could be made between Israel and these leaders. 866-34-TRUTH. Let us go to Georgia. Jeremiah, welcome to the Line of Fire.
Yes. Hey, Dr. Brown.
Hello.
I guess my... Yes, hello?
Go ahead.
Yes. I was wondering, I know some Jews will use the priest in Ezekiel, I think, chapter 46, as a proof text to show that the Messiah does sin because he was offering sin sacrifices for himself and for his nation. How do we answer that point coming in from a
sure.
Jew?
Yeah, so in Ezekiel chapters 40 through 48, there is a prophecy of a glorious future for the land of Israel with a glorious rebuilt temple, which also includes a functioning priesthood, which also includes blood sacrifices, and in which the prince offers sacrifices as well. So if that prince, in fact, is the Messiah, then why is he offering sacrifices for sin? How could that be Jesus? So in response to that, here's what we would say. Number one, nowhere does it say that this prince is the Messiah. Nowhere does it say that or even imply that. That's number one. There are other terms that are used for the Messiah in the Hebrew Scriptures and being associated with David in certain ways or being called the branch or other things, and none of those epithets are used regarding him. That's where we start. We'll tell you where we go after that when we come back. Stay tuned.
It's the Line of Fire with your host, activist, author, international speaker, and theologian, Dr. Michael Brown. Your voice of moral, cultural, and spiritual revolution. Get into the Line of Fire now by calling 866-34-TRUTH. Here again is Dr. Michael Brown.
Is God finished with Israel? The entire Bible says no. History says no. The future will also say no. Thanks for joining us today on the Line of Fire. You think this is Thursday? Is it Thoroughly Jewish Thursday? No, we're just having this emphasis because of the events taking place in the world today. 866-34-TRUTH. So Jeremiah in Georgia. So number one, there is nothing that says that the prince in Ezekiel 40 through 48 is the Messiah. That's number one. Number two, even for Judaism, these chapters present some difficulties because the layout of the temple there is different than the layout of the tabernacle / temple through Moses and Solomon, because of which there are questions about how this applies to the end. And number three, it doesn't even say that it's an end-time prophecy. The indication is this is what was going to happen when the Jewish exiles returned from Babylon. Now, the assumption is, because it didn't happen then, as I discussed with earlier prophecies, earlier in the show, it will happen at the end. But even so, if that's the case, if there is a temple with sacrifices, that could be so Israel can now teach the world the principles of blood atonement, etc., all that points to what Messiah did on the cross. So there's really not a major issue with it. If, in fact, there will be no more sacrifices of any kind, even pointing back to the cross, because what Jesus did was once and for all, and no memorial is needed other than communion that we currently have, then when we get there, we'll see these passages have more symbolic elements than we realize. If they are to be literally fulfilled, then again, that will be Israel's opportunity to instruct the nations in the ways of God, pointing to what we now know as the fulfillment at the cross. So just as the Old Testament sacrifices pointed to the cross, anything in the future would point back. 866-34-TRUTH. So in my article, Is God Finished with Israel?, up on our website, I strongly encourage you to read it, go through the scriptures, and then I even have recommended reading at the end, a bunch of books that will really help you. I point to Romans 9:4, and Paul writing in the present tense about Jewish people that are non-believers for whom his heart breaks because they're separated from the Messiah. Jews need Jesus to be saved just like Gentiles. Jews without Jesus are lost just like Gentiles without Jesus are lost. Romans 2:6-11 lays it out plainly. There's no partiality in God. The gospel comes to the Jew first and also the Gentile. Judgment comes to the Jew first and also the Gentile. Romans 9:4, Paul says, they are Israelites and to them belong, present tense, look it up in Greek, the adoption, the glory, the covenants, the giving of the law, the worship, and the promises, those still belong to Israel. What are some of those promises? How about Jeremiah 31, verses 35 to 37? Thus says the Lord, who gives the sun for light by day and the fixed order of the moon and the stars for light by night, who stirs up the sea so that its waves roar, the Lord of hosts is his name. If this fixed order departs from before me, declares the Lord, then shall the offspring of Israel cease from being a nation before me forever. Thus says the Lord, if the heavens above can be measured and the foundations of the earth below can be explored, then I will cast off all the offspring of Israel for all that they have done, declares the Lord. Wow. God says, no matter what, I won't cast them off. I'll preserve them as a nation. You say, well, God's changed the identity. Not all Israel is Israel. No. That's not what Paul was saying first. If God could just change the identity, then that makes him speaking double talk here. It has no meaning. It's like I sign a contract with you. No matter what, the contract's binding, and then I just change who you are. I don't like you anymore. I say someone else is you now. No, God doesn't do that. He's saying that there's a remnant within Israel that believes. Romans 9:6 and the verses following, there's an Israel within Israel, the remnant that believes. But then the rest of Romans 9:10-11, when he speaks of Israel, 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 every time he's speaking of the nation as a whole, count it 10 times. Just go through the verses as I've done and written on it and taught on it many a time. In fact, F.F. Bruce said this about Romans 11:26. In fact, I want to take a call on this in a moment. Romans 11:26, all Israel shall be saved. He said it is impossible to entertain an exegesis which takes Israel here in a different sense from Israel in verse 25, blindness in part happened to Israel. In other words, the Israel that has been temporarily blinded is the Israel that will be saved. That was Bruce's point. And then he said this, temporarily alienated for the advantage of the Gentiles, speaking of Jewish people, they've been temporarily alienated for the advantage of the Gentiles. They are eternally the object of God's electing love, because his promises once made to the patriarchs will never be revoked. No, God is not finished with Israel. You know, before the Holocaust, during the Holocaust, people might have said, well, God's finished with Israel. They're scattered among the nations. They've lost their peoplehood, their identity. They're just a small remnant of, you know, their numbers have not grown over the years like other nations have grown. And now, being so decimated, 2 out of 3 European Jews wiped out in the Holocaust, and many American Jews assimilating over the decades and losing their identity, and God's finished with, no. We've been miraculously preserved, and out of the ashes of the Holocaust, the modern nation of Israel has been rebuilt. That alone should demolish the idea that God's finished with Israel. Nonetheless, bad theology and bad ideas stick around so much that now that Israel's been in the land long enough, 70 years, celebrate it now, this week, now that that has happened, the critics will say, well, God's finished with it. It's just another state. No, friends. No. Perish the thought. Read the article, Is God Finished with Israel? Check out the volumes I recommend, including a new one. We'll be doing an interview, God willing, later next month on debunking preterism. Yeah, important. Debunking this idea that God stopped dealing with Israel in AD 70, that's when God forever cursed Israel, etc. No, 1,000 times no. All of the Bible shouts no to that. So we'll be addressing those wrong ideas, dangerously wrong ideas in the days to come. And here's a little principle for you. I got to tweet this out, in fact. A good little hermeneutical principle that'll save you a lot of problems. The Messiah coming into the world does not cancel God's promises to Israel, but confirms God's promises to Israel. Yeah, I just saved you a lot of error with that one little truth. And you find it in Romans 15, verses 8 and 9. All right, to the phones, Philip in Richmond, Virginia. Welcome to the Line of Fire.
Oh, thank you, Dr. Brown. Thank you for your ministry, and thank you for having me on. Romans 11, 25 through 32, I think you just spoke briefly about the F.F. Bruce commentary on 11:26, and so all Israel will be saved as it is written. Could you help me sort this passage out as far as trying to separate out the nation of Israel, the Jewish people, and how those promises apply?
Sure. So let's go through it. Paul has been writing about this big issue, this big question of how it is that nothing can separate us from the love of God, end of Romans 8, and yet it seems that the nation of Israel has rejected the Messiah when he came, and how can this be? And he says, beginning in verse 25, lest you be wise in your own eyes, I do not want you to be unaware of this mystery, brothers. He's writing to Gentile believers in Rome. And he says, I don't want you to be unaware of this truth about God's salvation plan that has been hidden, is now being revealed, lest you become arrogant, all right? So, lest you become wise in your own sight. In other words, if you think God's forever done with Israel, God's finished with the nation, you think, well, we've replaced them. We are the new kids on the block. We are the new Israel. And with that, you become arrogant and wise in your own eyes. He says, no. A partial hardening has come upon Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. So a partial hardening has come on the Jewish people as a nation. It's partial, meaning not on all Jews. There are always a remnant of believers. There's always a remnant of people like me, people like Paul, or Jewish believers throughout the ages, J. Seculo, the hundreds of thousands of Jewish believers today and over the decades. So it's not over the entire nation, and it's not for all time. There'll be a turning at the end of the age, all right? And in this way, all Israel will be saved. So as the fullness of the Gentiles comes in, that further provokes Israel to jealousy. That's the hope and Gentile prayer for Israel. And on the heels of this, in this way, all Israel will be saved. Speaking of the nation as a whole, there will be a national turning, just like Jeremiah 31:1 says that at that time, God will be the God of all the families of Israel, just like Zechariah 12:10 and following up to 13:1 speaks of the massive repentance that will come, just as a Jewish Jerusalem must welcome Messiah back, according to Matthew 23:39. Just as Peter says, as Jewish repentance comes, Acts 3:19-21, that the Messiah will return and set up his kingdom on the earth, fulfill all the promises given to the prophets about the restoration of all things. And this way, all Israel will be saved. As it is written, the deliverer will come from Zion. He will banish ungodliness from Jacob. And this will be my covenant with them when I take away their sins. So it speaks of the end time turning of the Jewish nation, not Jewish people through all ages. Jews have been lost through the ages like everyone else, but a final national repentance that God will somehow orchestrate in his wisdom and grace. As regards the gospel, they, meaning Jewish people today, are enemies for your sake, but as regards election, they are beloved for the sake of their forefathers. For the gifts and calling of God are irrevocable. For just as you were at one time disobedient to God, Gentiles, but now have received mercy because of their disobedience, Israel's disobedience, so they too, Jewish people, have now been disobedient in order that by the mercy shown to you, Gentiles, they, the Jews, may also receive mercy. For God has consigned all to disobedience that he may have mercy on all. That's the good news of the gospel. Hey, another reminder, friends, we launch our Jewish outreach broadcast in New York City, God willing, next month. We could really use your help now with startup costs and getting ready. Stand with us today in reaching Jewish people with the gospel. Would you do that? Go to askdrbrown.org, askdrbrown.org. Click on donate.